This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Was New York City's epicenter status just destined to be?
Lorraine, my density has popped me to you.
What?
I'm your density. I mean, your destiny.
What if pestilence is a city dweller? Pandemics naturally thrive most in big cities, Joel Kotkin wrote last month in Tablet magazine. Quote, people live cheek by jowl and are regularly exposed to people from other regions and countries. The Boston Globe predicted that social distancing will reignite, quote, America's suburban instincts. Sounds reasonable, even obvious.
Well, it seems to make sense. You know, cities are places of crowds, interaction, lots of movement. New York is, of course, the world's hot spot.
But as Sam Kling wrote this week in City Lab, when you look at infections on a per capita basis, you'll notice that coronavirus does not always seek out the most crowded city blocks.
But outside of New York, a lot of the suburban areas have rates that are just as high, sometimes higher than Manhattan.
Towns and villages presenting a united front as Nassau County declared a state of emergency.
The coronavirus map shows the town of Ramapo with the most cases by far in Rockland County.
Small towns in Georgia and Louisiana, they're also struggling with coronavirus.
As the virus rips through their rural community, for so many here, it's overwhelming.
With us being a small city, we're not New York, but we are still impacted.
In northern Italy, it wasn't really Milan that was hit hardest. It was the smaller towns and villages surrounding it. There are cities that are denser than New York, some of the most built-up places on the planet, like Hong Kong and Singapore and Tokyo and Seoul. They've all managed to overcome, I think, cities' vulnerabilities. So I think it's a bridge too far to say that density is destiny. In the coming months and the coming years, we'll be able to look back and get a better sense of how this actually played out. But in the absence of data, I think people are really making assumptions. And this idea that cities are particularly vulnerable to disease, to crime and vice, and all of these things, this is a very old idea making a reemergence right now because people don't really know what to think.
Cities have maybe always been associated with language like squalid, hotbed, miasma. In your piece for CityLab, you quote one of the great American anti-urbanists, Thomas Jefferson, writing, quote, pestilential to the morals, the health, and the liberties of man. He didn't seem very thrilled about city life. He was not alone.
No, and this really came to a high point in the mid-19th century. In the United States, before the mid-19th century, there weren't really many cities of size. But then all of a sudden, with industrialization and urbanization, cities were growing faster than ever before, and people noticed great poverty next to great wealth, political radicalism, social unrest, poor sanitation. And a lot of it was encapsulated in this new type of neighborhood that people called the slum. Civic leaders and reformers, they noticed that disease and vice and crime all concentrated there. And their explanation was that these social problems were a product of their environment, you know, the physical space of the city, the built environment. This is something that historians call moral environmentalism, the idea that the environment not just shapes people's physical character, but it also shapes their moral character. And of course, if the problem is the city environment, then that suggests all sorts of policy solutions that are aimed towards improving the city environment.
Well, on that point, over the years, social reform has been conflated with and central to urban reform. And speaking of central, you, in your work, cite one famous park. At the time, a well-intentioned answer to the physical and moral infirmity to which you refer, but you say the wrong answer.
Well, a partial answer. Parks were really the centerpiece of this urban reform movement based on moral environmentalism. The most famous example is Central Park in New York City, designed by Frederick Law Olmsted and Calvert Vaux. And the idea there was that the design wouldn't just give people fresh air and open space and all of these things that we appreciate today, but that it would literally solve the most pressing social problems of the 19th century city. In Central Park and in a lot of other Olmsted parks, he would build these promenades that were visually prominent so that if you were sitting on a lawn, you would be naturally inclined to look at it. And the idea was that moneyed people would walk down these promenades in their nice clothes and their middle-class manners, and working-class people would observe them. And as if by osmosis, they would adopt their values and they would become good Republican citizens.
Wait, let's like go to the privilege zoo?
Yes, sort of. And some of the things that we take for granted in parks today, like playing ball or even walking on the grass, that was banned in Central Park because Olmsted wanted this to be a place of quiet reflection where you could escape the busy chaos of the city and just relax. And he didn't want people engaging in active recreation.
In the 20th century, we saw that mentality of anti-urbanism laid bare by the language of the slum clearance movement.
In an effort to correct blighted conditions, city lands are reevaluated and undesirable areas are leveled to the ground.
Whether it's a gangrenous limb or Dutch elm disease, the treatment is removal of the rot. And you believe that these metaphors actually dictated or at least influenced public policy.
Yes. The ways that people understood the city in the 19th century, in the 20th century, and even in modern times is often through metaphors. And one of the most prominent metaphors in the early 20th century was that the city was like an ecosystem. And like ecosystems, it suffers blight. That suggests certain policy prescriptions. You want to remove the blight or else it'll spread throughout the city. Now, of course, when you have a metaphor like that, sometimes it kind of obscures the real contours of the problem. So maybe the solution to blight isn't to cut it out, but it's to address the root cause. One thing that happens when we picture density as destiny, it really lets our political leaders and our bad policies off the hook. We look past the inequality, the structural racism. And if we're focusing on the densest neighborhoods, well, that doesn't really map onto the most vulnerable populations. Now, I'm not arguing that density doesn't play any role, but density can also bring strengths. Big cities have a lot of tools in their toolkit to combat coronavirus. You know, they can concentrate resources. They can concentrate social services. And density can nurture what the sociologist Eric Kleinenberg calls social infrastructure. These are the community organizations, the senior centers, the libraries, and yes, even the public parks that nurture social ties among people. Kleinenberg found in a study of the Chicago heat wave of 1995 that neighborhoods that had these stronger social ties tended to do much better in disaster because people check up on their neighbors, they make sure that everyone's doing okay. The challenge for cities is to figure out how to build on those strengths and minimize the weaknesses.
This whole conversation is premised on the idea that we as a society have already sort of begun to formulate the notion that we got to get out to the fresh air. You know, it's like Green Acres.
Land spreading out so far and wide. Keep Manhattan, just give me that countryside.
What is the risk, you know, in the wake of coronavirus wave one, that people flee?
By blaming density, you're putting people at risk. Fleeing to the suburbs doesn't help you, necessarily. We don't have evidence of that. Social distancing is much more important than the place that you live. By defining this as a density problem, we're really missing a lot of how this actually plays out. You're ignoring the people in the small towns, you're ignoring the people in the suburbs, and you're ignoring the vulnerable populations in cities who are particularly at risk, not because they live in dense neighborhoods, but because, you know, they don't have PPE, or they have to keep going to work, or they don't have health insurance. And those are some of the big structural problems that I think we have to address.
Sam, thank you.
Thank you so much, Bob.
Sam Kling is a Global Cities Fellow with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs.